Chapter 4, High School. I started high school at the beginning of 1958, just a few months after federal troops were called out in Little Rock, Arkansas, to protect 9 black teenagers who enrolled in a previously segregated all-white high school. Berkeley might seem to be on the opposite end of the spectrum from Little Rock, and in many ways it was. But Berkeley was nonetheless still part of America, and the same issues would play themselves out, in different ways, in my high school years. I, of course, didn't understand it quite that way when I started high school. I was mostly just a 14-year-old kid trying to figure out where to fit in. Orientation. I remember two things from my first day at Berkeley High. First, my friend John and I had arranged that we would see each other. We were starting in February, so there was a one-week break at the end of January between junior high and high school. We'd agreed that the first day of school we'd hook up and kind of go through the experience together and continue to be tight as friends. But then when I got there, I looked all around for him, and he wasn't there. He wasn't there all that week or the next month. And then I found out he'd been busted and been sent to juvenile hall. So that was kind of a jolt for me. The second thing I remember is the orientation assembly for all the kids who'd just come into the 10th grade. The school was a 3-year school, 10th, 11th, and 12th grades. The February group was a smaller class than the one that started in September, but they still had a program for all the new kids who'd come from the 3 junior highs, Willard, Burbank, and Garfield. This was the first time we all got thrown together this way. I was walking around trying to find a place to sit because I got there a little late and a lot of the seats were taken. There was this one black kid who was leaning against the wall with his feet sticking out a little bit, just looking around. As I went by him, I very consciously made a point of walking around him so I wouldn't bump into him or anything, because I was uptight. Everybody in my junior high had always buzzed about how this was a big deal when you went to Berkeley High, and how you were going to have to deal with all this stuff, and maybe get in fights. So I was stepping very carefully. As I walked all the way around him, all of a sudden he turns toward me and says, "Hey man, you stepped on my dogs." "No, I didn't." "Yeah, you did, man. You stepped on my dogs." Now, by the time I was a senior in high school, this guy, whose name was Odell, was part of a singing group that I was also part of. This was how things went through changes. On that first day, though, he was just messing with me as part of the general thing that was going on. So that was my orientation. I don't remember anything the principal or teacher said, but I remember Odell. My earlier experiences didn't really count for much in this setting. Even though John had been my best friend in junior high school, he wasn't there, and in any case, that was a somewhat more limited experience. Although he went to the same school I did, he lived in a different part of town. We didn't go to each other's houses. Outside of school, our contact was just mainly on the phone. And my earlier experience at YMCA camp was as a younger kid. This was a big change. All of a sudden you were going to a school that was about half black, and there was a lot of cohesion among the black students as well. So they had a big influence. Plus there was a lot going on in the world. Things were changing. Black people were becoming much more self-assertive, proud of being black, and not putting up with any shit anymore. As I said, there were battles about desegregating the schools beginning to go on all over the country at that time, even in Berkeley, where the schools had been segregated. During the time I was in high school, my father got on the school board and was playing a leading role in the fight to desegregate the schools. So this was the larger context at that time, and this definitely had an effect where I was. I was quite nervous. I didn't react in the way I know some of the kids from Garfield did, with pretty traditional, straight-up racist kind of garbage. But I was still very uptight about the whole thing, because I didn't know what was going to happen. You don't know how lucky you are. Now, I learned to love this very quickly. But when you're first stepping into it, it's like, whoa. Especially in my second semester in high school, though, because that was football season, I started having closer interconnections and relations with people of all different races or nationalities, including a lot of black people. But some things happened even in my first semester that started taking me down a certain path, you might say. I'd already started to make friends with people that I knew were going to be on the football team, including people who'd gone to Burbank or Willard that I'd played against in sports. We were now in gym class together, All the guys who played a sport were put in the same gym classes. And so we started to break down some of these barriers. I got to know and started becoming friends with Langston Tabor, with whom I'd been in these shoving matches and near fights during that basketball game at Burbank. One day when our gym class instruction was in swimming, I was at the edge of the pool and Langston was just kind of hanging out nearby. All of a sudden, I looked up and there was this guy kind of looming over me. He looked down at me and said, "Is your name Bob Avakian?" And I answered, "Yeah." He went on, "Did you go to Garfield?" "Yeah." Next he asked, "Did you play basketball for Garfield? Did you play against Burbank?" Again I said, "Yeah." And now I'm trying to figure out where all this is going. And then came the punchline. "Did you foul me?" Now I really didn't know what was going on, but I just gave him a straightforward answer because I was sort of naive. I said, "I might have. I can't remember something like that." So then this big grin came over his face, almost like a leer or a smirk. He just kept that look for what seemed like minutes to me, but was probably only 10 or 15 seconds. Then he slowly turned and walked away. I was still trying to figure out what the hell was going on, and Langston comes up and says, "Man, you don't know how lucky you are. That's Jack McRae. He's one of the baddest dudes in the whole school." I said, "Yeah?" And Langston went on, "He was getting ready to fire on you. He was going to punch you out." I said, "What are you talking about, man? He was smiling." Langston laughed. "Yeah, but when he gets that smile on his face, that's when he's getting ready to unload on somebody." This made a big impression on me. I learned about Jack McRae a little more in high school and after high school. I even played basketball against him again at a rec center in Southwest Berkeley. It was all cool. I believe he's still sort of a legendary figure in the Sacramento Street section of Berkeley. But this was a very dramatic experience for me. And afterward, Langston kind of joked around with me about it and schooled me in how I might handle this kind of situation better. But he was getting a good laugh out of the fact that, probably to Jack, I just seemed so out of it that he decided, "I'll just let this white boy slide." There were a lot of encounters like this. It wasn't just me. This was a time when black people were fighting for justice and equality in the civil rights movement, and more generally. Even in their personal interactions with people, they were asserting themselves more. This was going on all throughout the school and in the larger society. As part of this, there was a lot of testing to see how you were going to react, to see what kind of person you are. Segregation within integration. While Berkeley High was integrated, in the sense that kids from all over the city went there, within the school it was very segregated. There was tracking and the classes were largely segregated. Not entirely, but to a large degree. The lunchroom was very segregated, and there would tend to be segregation even within the gym classes, where black and white students were mixed together. Generally, people did not hang out together socially, and things were segregated on that level too. As I started to make more friends among the black kids in school and to hang out with them, many of my white friends, or former friends, were not accepting of that. Not only were things still pretty segregated within the school was very stratified and very cliquish. Among the white students, you had these social clubs, which were basically junior versions of sororities and fraternities. The clubs were exclusively white, with the exception of one black female social club, and they were completely segregated. There were no integrated social clubs. Except for the black sorority, they were preserves of privilege and bastions of segregation in the school. They exerted a lot of influence, and they were generally hated by everyone who wasn't in them. The black kids especially, with very good reason, hated these social clubs. And a number of kids I had known in junior high, including some of my friends, joined these social clubs. I wasn't into that. I was making friends with all kinds of kids, including a lot of black kids. And the general attitude coming from the white kids that I had known in junior high was, "What are you doing?" In fact, there was one guy from junior high named Gary who came up to me and said, "I want to ask you something." I looked at him as if to say, "Yeah." Then he blurted out, "Why don't you stick with your own kind?" I looked him in the face and said, "You mean like you?" And that was the end of that conversation and of any friendship between us. I don't think that making new friends, especially with black kids, was any kind of conscious statement or anything like that. I didn't really think about it in what you might call social or political terms, except in situations like the time this guy Gary challenged me in this straight-up racist way. More, it was a matter of what I wanted to do. I started making friends with people I liked, and that was it. I hung out with a lot of different groups of people. For a couple of semesters, I regularly sat with this group of Japanese-American kids, mainly girls, during lunch, and they would talk about things that I hadn't really had much experience with or understanding of before that. I really liked them. They were very interesting, very intellectual, but they weren't snobbish or stuck up. Then there was my friend Keo, who was a white kid that I'd known ever since grammar school, even though he didn't go to the same grammar school as me. He was a real sports nut like me, but he also had a lot of other things going on. He was a couple of years ahead of me in school. I think he was only there for one semester when I was at Berkeley High, and then he graduated. But we often ate lunch together during that one semester. One day during school, he didn't show up for lunch, which was unusual. So after school, that evening, I called him up to ask him where he'd been. He said, "First fucking day of the fucking baseball season." The Giants had just moved from New York to San Francisco. I said, "Oh, really? You went to the game? Fucking A, man. Great game. Fucking great game." I asked what was so great about it. "Fucking Willie Mays. Unfucking believable. First fucking pitch. Fucking line drive over the fucking fence. Fucking home run. Unfucking believable." I said, "Kale, do you realize how many times you said fuck in the last 10 seconds? "No, how many?" I said, "Probably about a dozen." "Oh, fuck." I remember one day at lunch, he came in and he had this little drawing on a piece of paper. And I asked, "What's that?" He said, "You know, I've been thinking about infinity." I said, "Really? What about infinity?" "Yeah," he says, "see, I don't really think it's boundless in space, but I think it kind of winds back on itself." And he had this piece of paper with a drawing on it, one of those things where it would wind back on itself, like a Mobius strip or something like that. He said, "This is how I think infinity is." So then we started discussing infinity. This was completely out of nowhere, but he'd been thinking about infinity. On the one hand, he'd take off from school to go to the baseball game. Then another day he comes in talking about infinity, with this diagram to illustrate how he thought infinity was. From the time I was 13, his family, Keo, his two brothers, and his father, would go to track meets with me and my dad. As I said, we used to really love this sprinter at Cal, Lehman King. He was a world-class sprinter, but he was one of these guys who didn't like to practice. He'd run down the track a few times in these old gym shoes, practice a few starts, and that was it. We'd go to the Cal track where he was practicing, and we'd talk to him, ask him how he felt about the upcoming meets and things like that. They used to have this track meet called the West Coast Relays in Fresno every spring. We would get in our car, Keo's family and my family, or at least my dad and his brothers, Keo and me. We'd all pile in and go down to Fresno. We'd go to watch Lehman King run, and sometimes we had banners on our car saying things like, "Lehman, King of Fresno." Clarence, Lonnie, and larger forces. I remember these two black guys named Clarence and Lonnie. They were known by everybody in the school, I mean black, white, whatever, as being the kind of guys who were always causing shit. For example, when you would come out of the showers in gym class, they'd stand there and snap people with their towels, especially all the white guys, and they had this whole routine they did. One day I came out of the shower, and one of them snapped me in the butt with a towel. So I went up to Clarence and I said, "Hey Clarence, man, why'd you snap me in the butt with a towel?" He insisted, "That wasn't me, man, that was Lonnie." Then I go up to Lonnie and I say, "Lonnie, why'd you snap me in the butt with a towel, man?" "That wasn't me, man, that was Clarence." So they had this whole Lonnie and Clarence routine they did all the time. I think even there it had a little bit of a social meaning to it, reflecting what was going on in society on a larger scale. They didn't just snap everybody's butt. It was mainly the white guys. Now we had an open campus where you could go out at lunchtime and get snacks or go up to the stores a few blocks away. And there was one main street where people walked up and down and hung out. One day some guys from the football team, who were also part of this whole social club scene, were walking down the street. And on the other side of the street were Clarence and Lonnie and some of their friends. And either Clarence or Lonnie threw an ice cream cone and hit this white guy named John in the face. John was wearing his social club jacket, so he was like a walking provocation. John crossed the street with some of his friends and went up to Clarence and said, "Clarence, was that you that threw that ice cream cone at me?" And Clarence said, "No, man, that wasn't me, that was Lonnie." So then John says, Lonnie, you threw that ice cream cone at me? And Lonnie says, no, man, fuck you, and then starts yelling at him. Then Clarence starts pretending he's going to restrain Lonnie. Oh, come on, man. And all of a sudden, he wheels and punches John in the face. The whole street immediately broke out into these opposing lines, fighting up and down the street, blacks against whites, as if it were choreographed. I was hanging out with some kids, black and white, and we didn't get into it. But the fight went on for a while. It became a big deal in the school, and we all got the usual lectures about it. The football team got lectures about how we all hang together and blah, 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 as if there were no racism even in the football team. A few days later, when I came out of gym at the end of the school day, there was this long line of black guys who'd come from different schools around Oakland, as well as our school, and they had formed a kind of gauntlet. The reason I know they were from different schools is that I came out of gym with a couple of friends of mine, and they knew some of these guys. They had family connections or just social connections, and they told me, that guy is from McClyman's, that guy is from Castlemont, and so on. So I'm walking out and I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do, because every white guy coming out there in the aftermath of this fight is getting kicked and punched. I didn't particularly want to get kicked or punched. And as I'm getting ready to enter into this gauntlet, I see two or three guys that I know. So I said, hey, so-and-so, how's it going? And I held my breath and started walking. They nodded at me or said something back, and I managed to make it all the way through the gauntlet without being kicked and punched. Then I noticed once I was through, there were some other guys who came behind me, and the kicking and punching started again. But this was bigger than anything having to do with me. This was coming from the larger contradictions of society and the larger racist relations and racist ideas that were being challenged. And this was breaking out in a lot of ways. I mean, Lonnie and Clarence weren't politically conscious activists, and they had their own particular characters and things they did. But even though you could say that Lonnie and Clarence started it by throwing the ice cream cone, this whole social club thing was a standing, and in this case a walking, provocation. These guys wearing their social club jackets going down the street were making a statement, and people resented this for good reason. That was the provocation that led to this. People have these idealist visions of Berkeley as some place that's always been the way it became through the 60s. But there was a lot of open segregation and overt racism in Berkeley at that time. A couple of years after I left Berkeley High, in the early 60s, a really ugly racist incident took place. There was this area called the Slope where people would eat lunch outside. There were certain areas where the white kids ate and black kids better not come over and eat there or there'd be a fight. If you were a white kid, you could go eat where the black kids were, and some of us did. But if you were black, you did not go in these other areas. Finally, this came to a very overt and very ugly head during my younger sister's senior year. One night, some white kid from the South named Jeff and some of his friends drew a line on the Slope and wrote on it, Mason-Dixon Line. When the segregationist content became overt like that, fights broke out in the school, and then the lines were very clear. But things were beginning to change, and this guy Jeff and his friends were more isolated than they would have been even when I was in high school. I remember my friend Billy, who I'll talk about later, and who was in the same class as my sister. Billy put out the word when this happened that he was looking for this kid Jeff, and Jeff didn't show up at school for some time after this. But even in this earlier incident with Lonnie and Clarence, though it didn't have the same overt, clear-cut social content, we sensed and knew that this had something to do with these larger things going on in society. To one degree or another, many people, including myself, understood that, even if we didn't feel like getting into this particular fight. And that was true for some black friends of mine who also didn't feel like getting into it, because it was kind of like, oh man, that's Lonnie and Clarence. Yet everybody understood it was a bigger thing at the same time. Basketball, football, and larger forces. At that time, the basketball coach at Berkeley High, Sid Scott, was a Christian fundamentalist. He was always lecturing the players about religion. He was also a big racist. Every year when I was in high school, and even before I got there, the starting team would always be three black players and two white. My friends and I used to always talk and argue about why this was. Because while sometimes there were white guys who should have been on the starting five, a lot of times you could easily see there were five black players who should have started, or at least four. I thought that this coach's thinking went along the lines that if he had four black players and one white on the floor, the four black players would freeze out the white guy, so then they wouldn't all play together. even though, of course, this was ridiculous. And if he had five black guys out there, he figured all the discipline on the team would break and it would just be an undisciplined mess. Also ridiculous. And he couldn't have less than three black players because it was so outrageous, given who was on the team and how good different players were. This is how I used to analyze this. But when I would discuss this with a lot of my black friends, including ones on the basketball team, they would explain to me very patiently, "Look, man, it's not just Sid Scott. It's the alumni and all that kind of shit from the school. People who have more authority around the school. They don't want an all-black team out there. So this coach, yeah, he's a racist dog and all that, but it's not just him." And then I would argue, "No, it's him. He's a racist dog." And of course, they were much more right than I was. My friends and I would go to each other's houses, stay overnight at each other's houses, and we'd talk about this kind of stuff all the time. Especially the more the civil rights movement was picking up, and the more this carried over into all kinds of ways in which people were saying what had been on their minds for a long time, but were now expressing much more openly and assertively. One time when I was a senior in high school, our school got to play a night football game. Now, we didn't get to play many night games. They would always be afraid there'd be a riot at the game because of the nature of our student body. I think this was the only night game we ever played. We went on a bus trip to Vallejo, which is maybe 20-25 miles from Berkeley, and the bus ride took about an hour. During that time and on the way back after the game, I was sitting with some black friends of mine on the football team, and we got into this whole deep conversation about why there is so much racism in this country, why there is so much prejudice, and where does it come from, and can it ever change, and how could it change? This was mainly them talking and me listening. And I remember that very, very deeply. I learned a lot more in that 1 hour than I learned in hours of classroom time, even from some of the better teachers. Things like that discussion went on all the time on one level or another. But this bus ride was kind of a concentrated opportunity to get into all this. A lot of times when we were riding to games, we just talk about bullshit the way kids do. But sometimes it would get into heavy things like this. And there was something about this being a special occasion, this night game. We were traveling through the dark, and somehow this lent itself to more serious conversation. Dating and larger forces. I was not part of the social life that a lot of people with whom I'd gone to junior high were part of. There were girls who actually liked me, but they would say things like, "You know, I like you, but I can't go out with you because you hang around with all these black people," and things like that. And that instantly made me not want to go out with them anyway. There were things that were explicitly said like that. And then sometimes you could just tell the deal by the way people acted. And all this was being shaped by the larger things going on in society and the world. Whom you were even attracted to, and whom you were interested in going out with. Whom you were interested in as a girlfriend, and whom you wanted to be friends with. This was being shaped, or heavily influenced, by these larger things going on. There were taboos. You didn't date interracially. You didn't do that. There were a few kids in my class who did, and they took a lot of shit for it. In my senior year, there was one girl that I was very fond of, who was in glee club with me, and we went out for a little while. She was actually the head of the one black social club in the school. Now, it was a rule that every social club had to invite at least the president of every other social club to whatever function they had. So she was invited to a New Year's Eve dance sponsored by one of these white social clubs, and she asked me to be her date for that. I said, sure, because we liked each other. So we went, along with another couple, two black friends of hers. Of course, there's this whole tradition that on New Year's Eve, you give your date a big kiss when it strikes midnight. So at the dance, there was all this tension, because we were there and we were dancing together the whole night and hanging out together, just like any other couple would. Except, I could tell as it got to be 11:15, closer and closer to midnight, this palpable tension was in the air. What's going to happen when midnight comes? When midnight came, she and I gave each other the biggest imaginable kiss, both because we really liked each other, but also really wanted to make these people eat it. So we had a great time doing that. But it was a big deal. The tension there was very real. Of course, I got called things like nigger lover, and I didn't get invited to join these social clubs, which was nothing because I wouldn't have wanted to do that anyway. But whatever ways in which I was ostracized and outcast among the mainstream whites was really nothing compared to what my black friends went through. From the time I was a junior in high school, there were four of us who hung out together. Matthew, Joel, Hemby, and me. Two of us white, two of us black. We were always hanging out together. One time Matthew, who was black, really had a crush on this one white girl. He wanted to ask her out, and finally he worked up his courage and asked her out. And she told him, "Well, you know, I'd like to go out with you, but my parents and my friends and all this kind of shit." That was much more painful than anything that happened to me. It was very painful for me being his friend, and it was the kind of thing that I know left a deep scar in Matthew. It was just horrible and excruciating, and the scars of that were much deeper than anything that happened to me. Street Corner Symphonies. I had this friend, Sam. Actually, I knew him before high school because I went to a church in Berkeley where his father worked as the custodian, and he would come around and help his father sometimes. Then when I went to high school, he was a little bit ahead of me, but we became friends, and then we became part of a singing group. Sam had this one characteristic. When he was eating, he didn't want anybody to say anything to him. It was just leave him alone and let him eat. I don't care who it was or what the circumstances were. That was just Sam. You just knew you should stay away from him then, because he didn't want to talk. He wanted to eat. So one day I had forgotten to bring my lunch money, and I was really hungry by lunch. I couldn't pay for anything in the cafeteria or the snack shack or anything. I was walking all around looking for some friend to loan me some money. So first I went over to Sam, and I knew that I was violating his big rule, but I couldn't help it. I went over and I said, "Sam, leave me alone, man, leave me alone." I said, "Sam, I'm really hungry. Leave me alone, I'm eating lunch." So I just finally gave up there. But I started walking all around looking for someone to loan me some money or give me something to eat or something. Finally, I saw this guy who had a plate full of food. What particularly stuck out to me was that he had two pieces of cornbread on his tray. And that just seemed so unfair because I was so hungry and he had not one, but two pieces of cornbread. I just sat down at the table across from him and stared for a long time at his plate. He kept looking at me like, "What's this motherfucker staring at me for?" I just kept staring at his tray. And finally I said, "Hey man, can I have one of your pieces of cornbread?" "No man, get the fuck out of here." I said, "Please man, I'm really hungry. I forgot my lunch money. Can I please have a piece of cornbread?" "No man, get the fuck out of here." I don't know what came over me. Maybe it was just the hunger. But without thinking, I reached over and grabbed one of the pieces of cornbread. He kicked his chair back, jumped up, and got ready to fight. So I didn't have any choice. I jumped up too. He stared at me for a long time. A long time. And then he finally said, "Aw, man, go ahead." So I took the piece of cornbread. Then after that, Sam, who had looked up from his eating long enough to see all this, came over to me. Again, it was one of those things. And he said, "Man, that was Leo Wofford. You don't know what you just got away with." But I was so hungry, and I guess Leo figured, "Oh, this crazy white boy, he must really be hungry." So he just let it go. Sam lived in East Oakland, but he went to school in Berkeley. A few times I went out to his house. He lived right where East Oakland abutted against San Leandro, and it was like in the South. There was this creek and a fence right outside of 98th Avenue in East Oakland. And if you were black, you did not go on the other side of the fence into San Leandro, or these racist mobs would come after you. Sam lived right at the border there. A few times, Sam took me to places and events out in East Oakland. One time, we went to this housing project, which was kind of laid out in concentric circles, with a row of apartments arranged in a circle, and then another circle inside that, and then another one. And at the very center was a playground, where there was a basketball court. When we got there, there were some guys getting ready to play ball. I recognized a couple of them who ran track for Castlemont High. So I went over and got in the game. Well, at a certain point, one of these track guys and I got into a face-off. We'd been guarding each other and sometimes bumping and pushing each other, and then it just about got to the point of a fight. Everybody else stood back and gave us room. but after we stared at each other for a while, it didn't go any further, and we just got back to the game. But as this was happening, I noticed that Sam, who had been watching at the edge of the court, was turning and walking away. Another time, Sam and I went to a basketball game between Castlemont and Berkeley High. The game was at Castlemont, but I didn't have any sense, so I kept yelling shit at the Castlemont players. Their star player was a guy named Fred Sweetie Davis, and at one point he got knocked to the floor by a guy on our team. So I stood up and yelled, "How does it feel to be the one on the floor, Sweetie?" Sam had been trying to get me to stop acting the fool and shut up. And when this happened, he just got up and walked away like, "I don't know this crazy white boy." So sometimes, without meaning to, I put Sam in some very difficult situations. Sam was a really good singer. So one day I went to him and I asked, "Hey, Sam, you want to start up a group?" He thought about it for a while and then he got back to me and said, "Yeah, let's do it." Sam had a cousin named George who played piano, and George could also sing. So Sam said, "Let's get George in the group." And there was this other guy, Felton, who was one of the few black kids who had gone to junior high school where I did. So I went and asked him if he wanted to be part of it, and Felton said, "Yeah." And then I asked Randy, this white kid who'd been part of this impromptu singing group with John and me in our last year in junior high school. So the five of us, three black, two white, formed a group. We figured out pretty quickly that Sam should sing lead, at least on most of the songs, and then the others of us took our parts. You have to have a bass, and that was Felton. We had to have a baritone, and that was Randy. Then you had to have a second tenor, which was a lower range tenor, and that was George. And the first tenor was me. We had this whole thing worked out. Sometimes we practiced at George's house because he had a piano in his house, and sometimes we'd go to my house because we also had a piano. We'd spend 3 or 4 hours a lot of days just practicing, working on our music. And we'd sing anywhere we could get together to sing. This was part of a whole thing where people would get together, sometimes in formal groups, and sometimes just with whoever was around at the time, and sing everywhere. In the locker rooms before and after gym class, in the hallways and stairways at school, and out on the street corners. Eventually, Randy left the group, and then Odell. Odell, who'd claimed I'd stepped on his dogs way back on our first day of school, replaced him. When Odell replaced Randy, I reminded him of that run-in we'd had, and he didn't even remember it, but he got a big laugh out of my telling the story. Odell used to write songs. I'd see him out in the hallway. "Hey, Odell, what are you doing? How come you're not in class?" "I'm writing some songs, man." We'd practice and we'd try to get gigs, wanting to get paid and get known a little bit. We had to come up with a name for the group. There was already the Cadillacs and the Impalas, so we became the Continentals. Now, we'd also been rehearsing at the rec center at Live Oak, because they had a piano in there. The director of the rec center heard us and said, "Hey, I like your sound. Would you guys be willing to play for this dance we're having?" We answered, "Yeah, are you going to pay us?" And he said, "Well, we have a tight budget, but I could pay you something." So then we all got together and said, "How about $100? He came back with, "How about 25? We looked at each other and said, "Okay," because any money was good then. We rehearsed a lot for this, and we came there that night ready to do this heartbeat song, "You're 1,000 Miles Away, and some other tunes. As we were about to go in the rec center, this friend of Sam's who'd been playing basketball was coming over to get a drink of water. He said, "Sam, what are you doing here?" Sam said, "We're going to sing for this dance." "You can't sing, Sam." "Yeah, I can, man." So before we could go in to perform for the dance, we had to have a sing-off between Sam and his friend. They both did a spaniel song, and after a couple of verses, the other guy threw in the towel, because Sam could really sing. Another time, my younger sister got us a gig performing at their ninth grade dance. The other guys in the group said, "Okay, man, this is your sister's thing." So they let me sing lead on one song. I think it was called "Oh Happy Day." And that was a lot of fun. Some of the white parents just didn't relate to this music at all. And with some, there was a whole racist element in it, because it was the influence of black culture working its way into the mainstream. But a lot of the white youth were taking it up and were really into it, as exemplified by my older sister's junior high school class voting WPLJ as their favorite song. I think Richard Pryor made this point in one of his routines. When it's just black people doing something, then maybe they can contain it. But when it starts spilling over among the white youth, then, oh dear, everything's getting out of control. So there was that sort of shit, and there was a general thing among the racist and backward white kids where listening to this music and getting into this culture was part of a whole package of things you didn't do. They would give you shit for that, but it was just a part of a whole package of everything they were down on, and all the things they'd give you shit for. Besides singing doo-wop, I was in the glee club in school. When I was a senior, the glee club teacher talked me and three other guys, two of us black, two of us white, into doing a barbershop quartet song for the talent show. And we did it, with our own little touch to it. Another time when I was 16 or 17, I went to a Giants baseball game. Right before the game starts, they always have the national anthem, and I was still somewhat patriotic. I wasn't super patriotic, but I still thought this was a good country overall, even though I was very angry about discrimination and segregation and racism and all that. So we all stood up for the anthem, and for whatever reason, I started singing along. The song finished, and this woman in front of me turned around and said, "You know, you have a beautiful voice." I've often thought back on the irony of that. But it wasn't very long before I quit singing that. Later, when I would go to ball games and they would play the national anthem, I would stand up and sing, as loudly as I could, a version that someone I knew had made up. "Oh, Uncle Sam, get out of Vietnam. Get out, get out of Vietnam." Family clashes. We had these Armenian relatives in L.A. They were relatives of my father, but they were very unlike my father. They were very provincial, very snobbish, very big supporters of Billy Graham, and big-time racist. One time, my younger sister Mary Lou and I were staying in their house, and we got in an argument about all this kind of stuff. My dad's uncle, ironically his name was Sam, and we called him Uncle Sam, started this argument. And at one point he said to me, "Well, Bobby, what would you say about it and how would you feel if your younger sister Mary Lou started dating a Negro or even married a Negro?" And I answered, "Well, that's up to her. If she wants to do that, it's fine with me." So then we got into a big roaring argument. And here you see not only the racism, but also the patriarchy. He didn't ask her how she'd feel about it, and she was sitting right there. But it was as if she were invisible. Within our broader family circles, there was a lot of that kind of shit. As I mentioned earlier, Fresno was very segregated at that time. A lot of backward reactionary stuff was concentrated there. And my relatives were, again, sort of narrow provincial into a lot of this backward reactionary and racist stuff. When I was maybe 18 or 19, we were visiting down there on one of the holidays, and they asked me to do a dramatic reading of something that was being circulated in their circles. I didn't know what it was, so I agreed. When I started reading it, it turned out to be this racist parody about John Kennedy's son marrying Martin Luther King's daughter. All this racist garbage. When I realized what they were having me read, I just stopped and I got furious. And they must have regretted ever having given this to me to read. Because I just launched into a tirade against them and their segregated Fresno. "You don't know anything about black people. You refuse to go anywhere where they are. You avoid them. You with your freeway through the middle of town and all the segregation," and so on. I don't even remember everything I said, but it went on for about 5 minutes, and they all just sat there, frozen. Then I just threw the thing down and stalked out of the room, and it became, of course, a big episode in family relations. But they deserved it, and I didn't feel the least bit sorry about it. Now, I do have to say that when I was in high school, I drove to Fresno with some friends of mine, black and white, to go to the West Coast Relays. And my Auntie Bit and Uncle Beecher put us up in their house and were very warm and welcoming. Given the general atmosphere they were part of, that spoke to how they were very kind and generous people on a personal level. Still, the racism among my relatives in Fresno was very pervasive. Actually, while my dad and mom were quite different from this, they were liberals. They were at the time sort of typical liberals. They were against discrimination, segregation, and racism, especially in any kind of overt form. But at the time, they weren't completely free of some of the more subtle forms of this. I remember, for example, that in the same general time frame as that incident when we were visiting in Fresno, this was in the early 60s, A discussion came up when my parents, myself, and my younger sister Mary Lou were on a trip. My friend Matthew had started flirting with Mary Lou, writing her poems, calling her up and talking with her on the phone and all that. I wasn't sure how much this was a situation where he was actually infatuated with my sister and how much it was a matter of his testing us, testing me and testing my parents, to see what we would do. I think it was probably a little of both. Anyway, somehow this led to a discussion during this trip about interracial dating and marriage, and I was surprised and frankly shocked to hear my parents bringing up all the difficulties that would be involved in this, emphasizing this especially to my sister. After listening to this for a while, I got involved and things got pretty heated. Finally, I had had enough, and I told my parents in no uncertain terms, "I can't believe what I'm hearing. If you don't say that you wouldn't have a problem with Mary Lou going out with or marrying somebody black, then I'm leaving this family right now." Well, that kind of brought the argument to a crashing end. A kind of irony in all this is that some years later, my sister did marry somebody black, her boyfriend from high school, Buddy. And by that time, in the late 60s, my parents had gone through a lot of changes and genuinely welcomed Buddy into the family. Plato in the Park. To the degree that I was ever a jock, I kind of grew out of it because of a lot of different influences that had to do with the nature of the city I grew up in. I never grew out of being a sports fanatic, but you can be a sports fanatic without being a jock. A lot of the kids I knew who played sports in high school were also into other things. Some of them came from more academic or intellectual families, but also the people I was close with during my junior and senior years in high school, me, Matthew, Hemby, Joel, and some others, used to read Plato and Aristotle, John Stuart Mill and Shakespeare, and things like that. If we were hanging out having a hamburger, or if we'd be on the playground during a break between games, we'd start talking about all these different things we were reading, and we'd have debates. Some guys would make fun of us, but some others would join in. I remember having this one discussion with several people, and there was this question, I think it might have come from Descartes, about how God could draw a triangle without using a pencil. I said, "How can that be? How can he draw a triangle without using any kind of an instrument?" And my friend Matthew said, "Just by saying, there's a triangle." That was like one little sliver of the kind of conversations we had. It wasn't necessarily about God most of the time. Sometimes it was about John Stuart Mill's views on liberty or John Locke and the rights of individuals and how the different rights of individuals conflicted with each other, or about democracy. And of course, we talked about slavery, too. Before I got to a certain point in high school, I did my schoolwork, and I read what I was assigned to read, but that was it. Then all of a sudden, when I was 16 or so, I became really fascinated with all this discussion and wrangling over different ideas. This kind of thing may have been going on in other places, but I suspect it was more of a phenomenon in Berkeley because of the particular and almost peculiar mix of Berkeley. You have people coming out of the ghetto, and you have a lot of people who are related to the university. Like I said, even a reactionary asshole like Edward Tellerson was in one of my classes. We got into a debate where he was justifying the hydrogen bomb. So you had all these different kinds of things. My friend Matthew actually lived in Oakland, but he wanted to go to Berkeley High. He was a great athlete, and so they wanted him at the school, but he also wanted to go there because he and his parents thought it was better academically. So he came to our school, and he was very interested in and fascinated by all these big debates. It wasn't just the kids whose parents were professors or something. Matthew's father was a longshoreman, and his mother worked as a domestic worker. So it was a unique kind of mix. Matthew was a really good football player, and one day he called me up. "Guess where I am?" "Where?" "At the Air Force Academy." I exclaimed, "What the fuck are you doing at the Air Force Academy?" He said, "I'm thinking about going here. They're trying to recruit me." All I could say right then was something like, "Oh, fuck," because I'd grown up hating the military and all that kind of military discipline. So I really went after him when he got back. I said, "You want to eat meals where every bite you got to lift it up and make a square before it gets to your mouth? And you want to march in formation all over the fucking place?" I just kept after him and after him until finally he said, "Okay, man, okay. I won't go to the Air Force Academy."